important. He enters the plural in its proper alphabetical order, but he sometimes has no cross-reference under the singular. How many of, well, this is an interesting test at this point. How many of you know what the plural of ark, a piglet, is? Well, you'll find it under the letter I. It's I-R-K. I won't ask you the even more interesting question of how you explain such a change. He does exactly the same with bear and beer, a spit, but those, of course, are very close to one another. For eru, a ploughman, he gives the plural eruan at the point, but then later on, when we come to I, we find the plural iru, which wasn't mentioned along with the singular. So there are some sort of mechanical slip-ups in that sort of way. This, of course, is no disadvantage to the reader who finds the plural in a text and wants its meaning, but it's less useful to the writer who knows the singular but cannot remember the plural that he actually needs to use. That leaves us then with the parts of speech. With the disuse of instruction in formal grammar, this is perhaps the department any deficiency in which will least trouble the modern reader. Those whose education exposed them to the dreadful problems posed by a demand that every word in a passage should be assigned to one of eight classes will sympathize with Cregeen when he was faced with the same demand. Worse still, the Celtic languages have problems of their own, which no textbook of English grammar would have enabled him to solve. What do we do with those combinations of prepositions and personal pronouns? Or with some of the phrasal prepositions, which don't apparently have the prepositional bit visible? Or the interrogative and relative particles, which in Manx are reduced to zero? Can silence be a part of speech? Cregeen is all right with the easier items, but when presented with a tricky one, and they're tricky very often because he couldn't analyze them, he tended to go for adverb as the safe answer. Not the only safe answer. He has a number of answers which don't quite work. Can I just refer you to one or two? He gives air, A-A-R-E, as a verb. Thinking, I think there's a reference there, actually, and it's the phrase, hajige there, he will not come nigh, it shall not come nigh thee, actually, from the Psalms again. And, of course, it's a preposition. Bejachen, adverb, he says, well known. Well, well known in any case is an adjective, but what you've got there is the copula with an adjective, sort of two adjectives, one qualifying the other. Not surprisingly, it's a bit difficult to know what to do with that one. He has begun, given as a verb, not as a substantive, and glosses it less than little, which is rather obscure. Bliesh, or bliesh, masculine, noun, ownership. The form that means possessed, owned, it was his. And a wonderfully ingenious one, the word drom, D-R-O-M-M is the spelling of it in the text, which he gives as an adjective meaning drowsy. I hope no one's been ever tempted to use it as an adjective meaning drowsy, because it's quoted, he tells us where it comes from. It comes from the metrical version of Psalm 90 in the 1761 singing psalms, and I think it must be an old phrase that had come down, which obviously was no longer analyzable to him. It said dromnahi, literally upon the back of night, as an expression meaning throughout the night. But as I said just now, whatever his contemporaries may have thought of this part of his work, few modern readers will be anxious to cross-question him on the subject. But again, let them beware of imitating his method or copying his results. The last item which Grusin promised in the list of attractions on the title page was some etymological observations never before published. Kelly's unpublished manuscript dictionary contained some similar material, a little of which found its way through to the edition of 1866. We must remember, however, that what then passed as etymology, that is, the explanations of the origins of words in any particular language, was little better than ingenious guesswork. Kelly has recorded for us on a blank page of the manuscript dictionary his own, or perhaps a session of the Bible translator's, conjectures about the words contained in the Lord's Prayer in Manx. I reproduced these as an appendix to my lecture on Kelly's lexicographical methods, which I gave to the antiquarians in 1987. Men of education like Kelly and the clergy, of course, immediately thought in terms of comparisons between the Manx words with Latin and Greek. But however exact their knowledge of these languages, they were not ahead of the linguistic science of their time, which had not yet seized the essential point that vague similarities were not sufficient to establish a relationship between words in different languages, but the regular correspondences, capable of being illustrated from other words in the same languages, are necessary for proof. Where Kelly contented himself in his dictionary with citing material from Irish and Scottish Gaelic, though there are many inaccuracies in the printed edition, and quite a lot of inaccuracies in his interpretations, he was fairly safe, but the rest of his conjectures are, I think it's fair to say, worthless. Excuse me while I lubricate the machinery. Grusin had not Kelly's educational advantages, though Jeffcott tells us that without having made a special study of Scottish Gaelic, it is, Grusin could construe it without great difficulty, and that he once heard him translate at sight with apparent ease some Ossianic poems. If these were the supposed Gaelic originals of Macpherson's English Effusions, published after his death in 1807, actually, then, long after his death, really, about 30 years after his death, then Grusin certainly possessed, must have possessed, an extensive Gaelic vocabulary. All the more credit to him, then, that if he had this knowledge, he resisted the temptation, as Kelly did not, to smuggle it into his dictionary in disguise and pass it off as Manx. Grusin's etymologies, however, were not of the comparative kind, but hark back to a more ancient sort, highly approved of, in fact, the standard method of classical times, a method according to which words are derived from other words or combinations of words in the same language at the same time. They imply no sort of historical process. They don't have to be convincingly alike in form, and they certainly don't exhibit any regular correspondences of sounds. Perhaps we had better say that this aspect of the dictionary is nowadays best regarded as, I think to use a modern expression, the fun element, accepted for amusement only and a display of ingenuity on the part of the author. Perhaps, of course, and this is not to be despised, a way of helping words to stick in the student's mind. One or two of his conjectures. Banjach or Banjach fallow, he says, maybe from banya, milk, because used to feed milch cattle on. Brachten, he quotes Welsh brechdan, bread and butter, or a slice of buttered bread. Interesting, he couldn't know, of course, that in fact it works the other way round, not, I'm afraid, from, as far as one can tell, from Manx into Welsh, but from Old Irish into, or Middle Irish into Welsh. Brew, he is quite right about. Analogy with the Irish Brehon. Brehon, the Irish legal, native legal system. And of course, that's exactly true. On the other hand, he goes wildly off the rails with Chai, Lesh or Chai, this past day. And he wonders whether it's connected with Cachler, to change. Dunver, murderer, he gets right. It's interesting, though, that these etymologies are not infrequently claimed not to be his own, but they're presented as popular speculations. And this throws quite a new light on the linguistic sophistication of Cregeen and his neighbours in the early 19th century. He tells, I'll just quote a couple of those, both from the letter L. Liavi, he says, a bed. Some say from liebi, half food. But it's just as well to be, you get as much refreshment, if you like, as much strength and restoration of life from bed as you do from food. Or at least half as much, perhaps twice as much. Lianu, this is perhaps this may be a less convincing one to some. Lianu, a child, he says, some say, Lienu, a half saint. Well, once again, a warning to the unwary reader not to trust to the truth of this information. While some are correct, and I've cited a couple that are, the great majority of the etymologies, of course, are not reliable. All the aspects of the dictionary I've dealt with so far are concerned with the Manx words, their forms, accents, inflections, classification, and origins. The first promise of the title page is corresponding words or explanations in English. A bilingual dictionary can be used for more than one purpose. We now naturally use Cregeen to find the meanings in English of Manx words encountered in reading or in some other context. When it first came out, there were lots of Manx speakers about, of course, and they could use it to confirm, correct, and especially to extend their English vocabulary. For Cregeen did not content himself with one-word glosses whenever he could think of three or four synonyms, and on such occasions, his English vocabulary is highly literary. We may note in passing that this was part of his purpose, and his hope was that the dictionary might contribute in some degree to facilitate the acquisition of both the Manx and English languages. Now, such a wealth of renderings might lead the reader to see Manx as impoverished compared with such rich superfluity. But Cregeen does not let the reader get away with the idea that Manx has no distinctions between words and that in using it, any sort of approximation will do. On the contrary, he's at pains to point out the differences between words which, perhaps, when turned into English, come to be the same thing. He does, for example, include distinctions of two words for side, chow and liavi. He distinguishes between commius and budius, both of which are, in some sense, common property. In one place, he distinguishes, at least he says one has to distinguish, though he only gives one example, unfortunately, between the dunj, hunj, runj, the three prepositions, all of which one would have to translate into modern English as to us. They come after different verbs, or they have different senses. He enlarges on the polyvalency, the variety of values that the adjective glass can have. And then again, he goes on to distinguish between juch and jolosach, two words which one would probably translate as greedy or something of that kind. He comments, too, on usage. He says, for example, that the form brer is more frequent in verse than brech. But he believed, on the other hand, it was a contraction of brech, which is probably the wrong way round. He quotes the noun branleg and says that it would be better than porten for the word breeches, that is EA, not breeches, but breeches, in Judges 5:17. He criticizes the translators for not using the word he thinks. He quotes the noun crudach, creator, from the Paradise Lost translation, but nonetheless he prefers the form for crew. He labels the adjective debajach, which he translates desperate, as a low word. This is something that is characteristic of modern dictionaries, that you get some indication of the circumstances in which it's proper or might be dangerous or improper to use particular words. Their register, as it's called, is indicated. He says that the re is colloquial for the standard literary vignette that it is. And, of course, one senses a certain delight when he's able to note that a Manx word has no English equivalent. And he says this, for example, about the word bruil, an elaborate definition of something that is worn down by being hammered on and loses its point. Not surprisingly, he couldn't think of a word in English which corresponded to that degree of batterability. Of course, some of his definitions are obscure, but that's usually because he was defining some technical term or practice which our ignorance of the details of everyday life and activities 2 centuries ago doesn't equip us to understand. He has the definition of burr, B-U-R-R, an masculine noun, which he defines as the situation of a boat or vessel when at anchor and the wind blowing cross on the tide and the vessel standing between them both. Doesn't actually tell us how you use that even then, whether you say it is some preposition plus this word or what. Attack in sailing, which is his second gloss on it, is certainly more intelligible. One or two of his definitions, by the way, are misleading by accident. He glosses askage, a boil, by bile, B-I-L-E, which was no doubt the pronunciation he used. It was the ordinary pronunciation of many oi words in English dialect. But unfortunately, of course, B-I-L-E is a word which means something else. I think Buch glossed bilge is a misprint for bulge, because it's glossed as protuberance, as the second entry. Bui, B-W-O-I-E, I told you, well, Manx was full of clusters of vowels, is glossed boy, B-O-Y, but of course the sense is B-U-O-Y. Gob-du, he glosses as muscle. Muscle is all right when I say it, but he actually spells it M-U-S-C-L-E. So there are a number of these cases where one has to be careful about the spelling too. Finally, perhaps, we may ask whether Cregeen got it right. This, of course, is several questions in one, and it needs to be broken down into its constituent parts. Firstly, then, did he go about it the right way? The great model of dictionary making has long been taken to be the Oxford Dictionary, or to give it its original title before the Oxford University Press adopted it, the New English Dictionary on Historical Principles. Its creation was resolved on by the Philological Society in 1858, And the first part of A appeared in 1884. Interesting sort of coincidence. It was just a century after Cregeen's birth. And the whole was completed in 1928. 26 years to organise and make sufficient progress with the collection of material, largely by volunteer readers, and to establish the principles of arrangement and the details of typography. Then 44 years of editing to bring the whole enterprise to its conclusion. More recently, and perhaps more relevantly, the Dictionary of Old and Middle Irish took from 1913 to 1976 to appear. There were some long gaps, it's fair to say, when they weren't actually working at it. The University of Wales's Welsh Dictionary, which began 40 years ago in 1950, has at the moment reached only the beginning of the letter O, which is just under three quarters of the whole, and it suggests completion at the present rate in about 15 years' time. Well, no Manx dictionary, of course, could ever be on the scale of these. The material is just not there. But I mention these instances as indications of the size of the task that confronts a lexicographer. And all these, of course, were collaborative enterprises which have worn out generations of editors and their assistants in the course of their production. Cregeen lived in an age when single-handed lexicography still seemed possible, and before these modern examples were there to intimidate the individual worker. He had a grasp, however, of the fundamental requirements, requirements which were already realised by the Philological Society when it started the Oxford Dictionary, or they called it the Society's Dictionary in those days, when it first started it off. First of all, that it was to be comprehensive, not to be selective as early lexicography had been, confining itself to explaining hard words. Secondly, to provide references to sources and dates for its words. And thirdly, to give quotations illustrative of meaning and usage. Well, for Manx, it was easier to attempt comprehensiveness than the two other desiderata. In his introduction, Cregeen tells us that to place his book within the reach of the peasantry of the Isle of Man, it had been greatly abridged from what he first intended. Unfortunately, he gives us no indication of how this abridgment had been achieved, and whether it involved cutting out items of vocabulary or concerned only pruning the manner of presentation. He noted in the same sentence that the Bible and prayer book contained little more than two-thirds of the vocabulary of the language. I haven't tried to make any calculation of the proportion of words in the dictionary for which no biblical source could be cited, or the reverse, but I shouldn't be surprised if his estimate were true or even over-generous. It is, of course, precisely for those words that are not recorded in any printed or manuscript sources that we're indebted to Cregeen for preserving, for most of them must otherwise inevitably have been lost. He was right, too, in his method of collecting from the printed sources available to him and then going out and noting what was to be heard in the conversation of his contemporaries, as Jephcott tells us his practice was. To a limited extent, he fulfilled the second requirement, reference to sources. And there are a good many, mostly scripture references, in the dictionary, some to the Leorna Hymnon, I think from the edition of 1799, to judge from the numbers of the hymns cited. And also, to a limited extent, he met the third requirement of illustrative phrases, and particularly by inserting his proverbial sayings. So much for the material. What of the management of what he collected? One of the most striking features of the dictionary is the inclusion of a great number of words showing initial mutations, sometimes with the cause of the mutation indicated, but very often not. This is something unparalleled, as far as I know, in any dictionary of any Celtic language, and of course it takes up a great deal of space, along with such items as the copula s or sh, before positive adjectives in an exclamatory sense, and before comparatives. One only hopes that nothing of greater value was excised in order to leave room for these superfluous entries. Superfluous, that is, to anyone who understood the construction of the language. Comparison with the way in which the verbs are presented, that is, a base form, often equivalent to the singular imperative, but I think never identified as such, followed by a series of suffixes with paragraph references to the grammar, makes it look as though Krugin intended the dictionary to provide the means of parsing any inflected verbal form one might encounter. Whether, I'll take one particular example, because he does take the verb trogal. Now, it appears first of all under D, secondly under H, and thirdly under T. Now, one might say, therefore, you could come across hadrog, he will not raise, or chrogach, would raise, or trogi, will raise, by indicating the radical form and meaning on each occasion and reminding the reader where to look for the meaning of the suffix. He did not, however, follow this through consistently by limiting the suffixes to those possible in each case. For example, the nasal one could only occur in drog, drogum, drogany, drogach, and drogal. None of the other forms are possible. I won't go through all the possibilities. By not doing so, he runs the risk of confusing the reader by including suffixes which imply forms that cannot occur, forms like drogus, or hrogum, which is just possible if it's a relative, or trogach, or trogany, or trogus, all of which are quite impossible. The intention was well-meaning, I'm sure, but a little more space spent on the grammar and a specimen paradigm of a regular verb, to say nothing of paradigms of the irregular verbs, in whose eccentricities Krugin seems positively to revel, and which nonetheless he leaves a total mystery, would have removed the need for this expenditure of space. Last of all, you'll be glad to hear, was the plan for a Manx English dictionary the best thing? For his divinity students and advocates, who were perhaps two of the major classes of person he had in mind, there are many of the advocates, incidentally, in his subscription list, including Jeffcott himself. Would not an English Manx dictionary have been more useful? George Quayle, in the letter I mentioned earlier, certainly thought so. He believed it would be a more commercial proposition, and he very kindly recommended and indeed offered to lend a copy of an English Gaelic dictionary, which from the date, 1828, must be the Highland Society's dictionary. Though there were, in fact, several others to choose from, Shaw's in 1780, to which Krugin refers to under the noun re, for the moon, is one. It had an English Gaelic half. So had MacLeod and Dewar in 1831, and Armstrong's in 1825 had a substantial English Gaelic section too. Not for nothing does the guide to Gaelic Scotland say that the first half of the 19th century was the golden age of Gaelic lexicography. He offered to lend him one of these in the belief that it would abridge his labour, certainly save him the trouble of choosing what English words to provide Manx equivalents for. Now, whether word of this suggestion ever reached Krugin, I don't know. But in any case, he'd anticipated the idea in his introduction, writing that the Manx dictionary, if received with indulgence, might be followed by its counterpart, English rendered into Manx. But it was not to be. For whether or not he began work on the companion volume, he was not given the time to complete it. But nevertheless, he had already done enough to secure his reputation. With no model to follow, because Kelly's dictionary, of course, was not published again until later, without the educational advantages that Kelly had, he succeeded in producing a dictionary which met all the needs of his readers, was indeed, if anything, too indulgent to their laziness, and yet which was arranged in accordance with principles not yet enunciated or fully accepted. He desired, he says in the introduction, to to assist his contemporaries and to preserve that very ancient language, the Manx or Gaelic, to generations yet unborn. And he succeeded. And in succeeding, he has created for himself an enduring memorial. Thank you.
If there are any questions, Robert says he will try to answer them. I'm sure there must be.
There's very little in the dictionary to indicate that words were used appertaining to cooking and the household chores and so on. Does this suggest that his wife either didn't speak Manx or that Manx was not used at home?
Well, that's an interesting idea. I must admit, I hadn't thought of that. You may remember that in the memoir, Jeffcott hints that his wife was not very friendly to his lexicographical labours. She thought that they took up too much time. Jeffcott says, actually, time which might be better devoted to her, I think.
Yeah.
But... she might also, of course, have felt that he was wasting his time. He could have been making money. He could have been working, taking on other jobs, which would have been remunerative, and that would have been better for them both. Yes, it's quite true. This is, on the other hand, it's difficult to think that his wife would not have been Manx speaking. In Peel in 1798. There is, of course, a vague possibility that she was, I suppose we'd have to say nowadays, a social climber. She was upwardly mobile. It's rather interesting, actually. I don't know whether anyone has any suggestion as to why his parents gave him the name Archibald. Is a very, very unusual name. It's very common in Scotland, even in Gaelic Scotland, but there it's regarded as the standard English equivalent of Gillespie, which is really essentially one of the old religious names. He called the first three children by rather unusual names. Charlotte, I think probably that's the royal family. But then Jonathan and Francis, I think, also rather stick out. And one does just wonder whether there was an element of ambition in the family somewhere.
A comment on the, yes. Archibald.
Is, yeah, oh, please, yes.
Quite a frequent surname, Archibald, in the parish registers in Germany in the 18th century.
In Germany, yes. Yes.
Family,
yes.
So
that's interesting, yes.
Yes,
yes. Yes, yes, yes. Yes.
It could be a maternal or... A
that's right, yes, yes. Yes, we... I don't know that any attempt has been made to trace his father's family. They were living in Arbury, as we know, when his eldest brother was born. Unless I missed them, the second and third brothers must have been registered somewhere else. But where that was, I haven't discovered yet. So they may have had other connections. Yes, they may have had other connections somewhere. Yes, it's just that I certainly haven't noticed it in any other family in the Arbury group.
So it's as a surname?
Yes, Yes, that's sometimes Archbold, of course, isn't it, too, without the... there's another variant of that, yes. Thank you, though. It's an interesting... It suggests it was at least in circulation. Yes, please.
Given that Magnus was a spoken language in Gradina's day, can you think of a reason why he tackled the verbs so oddly in the introduction to the dictionary? Is that they don't seem to correspond to reality in any case?
Yes, I think to some extent he may have been under the influence of a theory. Which is always a bit dangerous. He has one or two odd ones. For example, he expected things to be more regular than they were. He has an entry, Breach, B-R-E-Y-A-G-H. It's a form which, well, it'd have to be negative, first of all. But he says, we pronounce this Berach, B-E-R-R-A-G-H. Now, that is in fact Verach, actually. It should be, of course. He disregards the lenition. He knew Bray in the sense of to give birth of animals. And he probably had grasped that this was the verb noun of that verb. But he wanted to make the conditional by adding the regular suffix onto the stem, which is not the way it is, because it's a long story, but in fact the verb noun, these are inherited differences that go back many centuries, but the form bre, in fact, has no vowel between the B and the R and never had. So he's given us G-U-I-N, and he says this is the Manx word for pain. Instead of having pien, he recognises that as a loan word of some sort. Then he has the adjectival form of it, painful, sore, and he writes G-U-I-N-N, I think, A-G-H. And then says, we pronounce this gonach. So there you are again, you see, you've got the notion that there ought to be an ach adjective formed from that noun, and he puts it in, but he does admit that it doesn't actually have in form the form that he has assigned to it. He wasn't in a position, of course, to recognize that the G-O-N and the G-U-I-N were ordinary variants within the grammatical system of Old Irish. I think that may have had something to do with it. Or indeed, as far as the ones I was alluding to, where you get suffixes quoted which couldn't have gone with that particular form of the base. I think that's just mechanical. I think he put the whole lot in every time because it was too much trouble to sort out the ones that were relevant.
Okay.
Yes, I think so, yes.
Well, I think you'll agree, ladies and gentlemen, we have had a most interesting lecture tonight, which has given us a great deal of insight into the work of Archibald Cregeen. One of the Scottish lexicographers, I think it may have been Shaw, said that his work was work on a language which was expiring. And I think possibly many people may have thought in Cregeen's time that this was also the case with Manx. But Cregeen's work is in fact a great source of inspiration to us and will be a means of ensuring that Manx continues to live and breathe for at least a few generations more, albeit on a much smaller scale than in Cregeen's time. I'm a person myself that likes dictionaries, but I'm always aware that they have pitfalls, and I often think it's a great mistake to read dictionaries more than one reads texts. The two should be complementary. And we should always remember, of course, that English words in dictionaries produced as long ago as Cregeen's was may not have the meanings or the connotations which they have for us today. Certainly, if you look in Kelly, for example, under the word gin, which most of us would take to be the drink today, you will find words which mean gin as it occurs in gin trap. You get words meaning snare and so on. I'm also interested too in what people who perhaps have not English as their native language make of Manx dictionaries. My wife and I saw a lovely example of this not far away from here. There's a flat which has a name on it which is actually there twice. And it says, she, brackets F, Argne. If you go around the corner, you see it says, she, capital F, Argne. Joan and I looked at this and we thought, it must mean peace of mind. But is it sort of peace of mind with a sort of abbreviated English of in the middle? Or what? We wondered. Joan plucked up courage and she went and knocked on the door. And a Chinese lady came out and explained to us that it did indeed mean peace of mind, and she had got what she had put on the door out of the dictionary. We thought it perhaps unkind to inform her that the F meant feminine. Folk etymology is not a dead art. There are several expressions in English which relate to people of other races. There used to be a common expression, the Young Turks. There was a phrase that somebody had caught a Tartar. There were also frequent references in the past to a very cruel North African people called the Tuareg, which has come out in modern English, at least in southern England, as Torag. And I recently saw a beautiful folk etymology of this, which seemed to refer to some practice of binding a gouty big toe with strips of linen. So, dictionaries do indeed have their perils. They are, of course, though, a great source of interest to us. And I commend all the Manx dictionaries to your attention. And we are perhaps very fortunate indeed today that we can, in fact, go to shops and buy copies of most of them. I was reminded, too, by something Robert said, that it might be a good idea if those of us who remember from my youth the little sort of rhymes that we used to come out with as kids and write them down. The particular one I thought of was when you mentioned Cregeen's spelling of bile, that the word boil would have been pronounced as bile, because I remember as a kid we used to plague lads at school whose name was Kelly by running after them singing, "Little Tommy Kelly was an engine driver, hit him in the belly and burst his biler." So if any of you can remember any more of those, I'd be interested to hear. There was another lovely one too, when you saw an ambulance go by. You used to say, "Touch your collar, never follow. Cross your fingers till you see a dog." Not perhaps as interesting as Cregeen's etymologies, but nonetheless, perhaps these little bits of folklore might be worth preserving. However, that's an aside. Thank you very much indeed, Robert, for a most interesting and illuminating lecture. We are grateful for your giving us your second lecture, which was the seventh
in the series. And Robert says that perhaps in a few years' time he might be prevailed upon to give us a third. So could I suggest Moseley as an idea?
Yes.
Anyway, thank you again. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for coming, for being an attentive and appreciative audience. And finally, may I say that if you can go upstairs to the seminar rooms, you will find a cup of tea or coffee and a bicky to regale you before you go. Thank you all very much.